Good evening and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Petit Trianon in downtown San Jose. My name is Terry Christensen. It's my pleasure to introduce Thomas Frank, journalist and author of The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Ruined Government, Enriched Themselves, and Beggared the Nation. Thomas is the founding editor of The Baffler, a business and a political and cultural magazine, which was published until 2007, but recently announced that it will be revived on a biannual basis starting this fall. As an historian and analyst of politics, Thomas has authored several books, including his very well-known 2004 bestseller, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Hearts of America. The recipient of the Lannan Literary Award for Nonfiction, Thomas was a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine and last year joined the Wall Street Journal as a weekly columnist. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Thomas Frank.
Thank you all for having me out here. I've never been to San Jose before, so this is a first for me. It looks like a beautiful, very beautiful town. It certainly is a beautiful day, anyways. The flowers are blooming. It's just the craziest damn thing. All the way down here, I saw these gorgeous purple flowers. I have no idea what they are. I want to find out. But first, we're going to have some, a good half hour really partisan boredom. Okay. Actually, I'm going to try to not be partisan. I'm going to fail. But I'm just so. I think that lemonade is alcoholic. I believe it has alcohol in it. If you take a look at the headlines today, the last couple days, and seeing what's going on in the country, I think it's clear that our current furious political debate is also to some degree a debate over history. When our friends on the right scream that President Obama is a socialist, that he has these sort of special powers for indoctrinating young people, when they tell us that last year's financial crisis was actually the result of government meddling in the economy, and I saw this in the Washington Post just yesterday, when they say these things, I think they're also advancing a particular understanding of the politics of the last 30 years, by which I mean an understanding in which they themselves had no role and deserve none of the blame. There was no conservative Congress or conservative Bush administration allowing bankers to do as they liked. Those people were, in fact, imposters, right? You've heard the theory. So when government failed, as it did so spectacularly in those years, most notably in the case of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, that wasn't a reflection on the people who were running FEMA at the time. It was because government always fails. Now, and you hear this all the time as well. This is in the newspaper just about every day. Now, this evasion of responsibility is one of the reasons I wrote The Wrecking Crew, the book that's just come out in paperback. The conservative revolution in this country began nearly 30 years ago, or 40, depending on whether you want to go all the way back to 1968. And conservatives have ruled on and off in Washington from, 30 years ago, basically up till earlier this year. And yet it's extremely difficult to get from them a simple statement of what conservative governance is, right? It was in power for all these years, and yet it's very difficult to just get to the bottom of it and figure out what it was. What is or what was the conservative state, right? Well, don't ask conservatives because they don't know. As former House Speaker Tom DeLay wrote last year in the Washington Times, conservatism hasn't been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried. So the thing is, there never was a conservative Congress. They never got a chance, right? But of course, there is a conservative philosophy of government, and it proceeds directly from the time-honored faith of chambers of commerce everywhere, that government is the problem, as Ronald Reagan once said, that government is a force of unique malevolence, that government's offending functions must be hacked apart, shut down, starved to death, drowned in a bathtub, outsourced, privatized, and otherwise rendered harmless. So conservatism is to a great degree about government failure. When conservatives are in opposition, as they are today, they see government failure everywhere. When conservatives are in charge of government, they make it fail. Now, not deliberately, mind you. They don't do this on purpose, and they don't do it in every circumstance, but definitely in the departments and the agencies and things like that that they don't approve of. Now, of course, then when conservatives come back into opposition, they tell you that all of that just happened because, look, that's just the way it goes. The guys who bungled the job weren't real conservatives. And besides, government always fails. I was on the radio this morning and a caller phoned in and told me that George W. Bush was, in fact, a liberal. Not just a liberal. He was very liberal, which is why I voted for him several times. Because I'm very liberal. Anyhow, a government that works, some conservatives fear, is dangerous stuff. It gives people ideas. Universal health care isn't just a bad thing for their pals in the insurance industry. It's a gateway drug to broader state involvement in the economy, and hence a possible doomsday scenario for conservatism itself. Now, on the other hand, government fails constantly when conservatives run it because making it work would be, for a lot of those conservatives, to traduce the very laws of nature. Besides, as we can now see, bungling the Katrina recovery pays conservatives huge dividends later on down the road. It gives them potent ammunition to use when the liberals have come back and are proposing another one of their grand schemes to reform health care or something like that. So what do conservatives believe in when it comes to running the state? Well, we know the answer. It's the market, right? The market is real democracy. Now, guys who merely win elections, on the other hand, those guys are tyrants, dictators, socialists, that sort of thing. The market is real democracy. The market is the only legitimate ruler. And if conservatives have a grand theory of government, it is this, that government should be market-based, as George W. Bush said back in 2001. Now, what did he mean when he said that? Government should be market-based. It really is an interesting thought. Now, what does it mean to put government on a market-based footing, to turn the functions of the state over to the market? Now, the short answer, as we all learned back in the Bush years, is, of course, lousy government, right, with health and safety codes unenforced, labor law basically completely gone, incompetence on a heroic scale, the catastrophic occupation of Iraq, and the self-destruction of the deregulated and largely unsupervised financial industry. Governments like the last one routinely appoint industry lobbyists to run the regulatory departments that oversee those industries, and they routinely put people hostile to some particular branch of government, say the Social Security Administration, in charge of that branch of government. Now, you used to be able to find examples of this sort of thing all the time. They were in the newspaper just about every day. It wasn't just a matter of banking regulators utterly missing the crisis in mortgage debt. You know, that was just part of the pattern. There's dozens of other examples. Remember how the Federal Aviation Administration used to regard the airlines, not the public, but the airlines as their customers, and that was actually the term that they would use, and they would, of course, then go easy on them when time came to inspect their airplanes. Or how there was a branch of the Department of the Interior in the Bush years, it became so cozy with big oil that they were actually physically getting it on with these guys. You know, in Washington, we often say that regulators are in bed with industry, and we mean that figuratively. But in this particular case, it was literal. It was really happening. And you can pile up dozens, if not hundreds, of similar examples concerning the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Agriculture, and the poor old Environmental Protection Agency. Now, one place that the wrecking was most systematically done was in the nonpartisan civil service, which is, civil service is an essential element of every advanced industrial society. Every Western country has it. You and I take it for granted. Conservatives, though, hate it. They call it a permanent government. This is a term that President Reagan used, I believe, or maybe it's Gingrich. I'm sorry, I'm getting a lot of this stuff confused these days, but it's in the Wrecking Crew. You can check it out. The permanent government. And it has an entrenched liberal agenda that you have to beat down with a strong hand. So one of the most interesting things that I found while I was researching the Wrecking Crew was a 1928 interview with the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which was then, as it still is today, one of the great powers of conservative D.C. And in the interview, the dude made the following proclamation. This is what he said. The best public servant is the worst one. Okay? Think about that. The best public servant is the worst one. What did he mean by that? He meant that you have to keep talented people out of government at all costs. Well, why on earth would you want to do that? Because if you have talented people in government, then government will work. And if government works, then people will consider handing over more and more power to it. And obviously, this would not only be bad for business, but the first step on the slippery slope to communism. That's right. Which is, I guess, where we find ourselves today. Anyhow, it's a... Okay, that's a joke. Not really. And this is a... When I first read this, I thought, man, that is peculiar. The best public servant is the worst one. But in fact, this turned out, as I did my research, this turned out to be a theme that you find repeated over and over and over again in the history of the conservative movement. This idea that you have to keep the best and the brightest out of public service. The ideal public servant, according to the conservative movement, is, of course, a movement loyalist. That's who you want running government agencies. That's who you want in charge of, say, the Securities and Exchange Commission or the panel that makes sure that kids' toys are safe, right? A movement loyalist. And the most direct statement of this principle came from Grover Norquist, who y'all may or may not know. He's one of the most brilliant strategists on the Washington right. And this is what he said in a speech that he gave way back in 1986. Here's what he said. First, we want to remove liberal personnel from the political process. Then we want to capture those positions of power and influence for conservatives. Stalin taught the importance of this principle. He was running the personnel department while Trotsky was fighting the White Army. When push came to shove for control of the Soviet Union, Stalin won. His people were in place and Trotsky's were not. With this principle in mind, conservatives must do all they can to make sure that they get jobs in Washington. With that principle in mind, handed down from Uncle Joe. Now, since it is a basic principle of the conservative movement, and by that I mean it is an axiom, it is a cornerstone, it is an immutable law of human nature that turning over government operations to the private businesses is the most efficient way to get anything done. The ultimate answer to the problem of the civil service is to, right, outsource it. You know the answer, right? You outsource the job. You turn it over to the private sector. And this was the signature gesture of conservative administrations, handing over public functions to the private sector everywhere from New Orleans to Baghdad and from the Department of Homeland Security to the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, y'all know the story. In reality, the conservative system of outsourcing turned out to be, instead of saving us money and being more efficient and all that sort of thing, it turned out to be a ripoff of mammoth proportions. In each of the great initiatives of the last administration, you know, the anti-terrorism, recovery from Hurricane Katrina, and the administration of Iraq, privatized government got a starring role and proved itself to be a gold-plated botch. Again, again, and again, despite a veritable river of dollars, it failed to deliver what was promised. In the Bush years, the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security routinely accepted contracts that were so ill-written that they seemed to have been designed more as a way to sluice taxpayer billions into contractors' pockets than as a device for actually getting something done. And of course, since the contractors are private companies, they're pretty much shielded from oversight and accountability. Now, digression here. One of the most interesting things about conservative D.C. is this is a movement that hates government, or you know, despises government, or however you want to put it, and yet, when they're in charge, Washington, D.C. prospers dramatically. Washington, D.C. is presently the richest city in America, largely thanks to the policies of the Bush administration, all the outsourcing, the prosperity that descended upon K Street, that sort of thing. The Reagan administration did similar, you know, wonderful things for Washington, D.C. So if you really hate Washington, D.C., vote for those liberals. Okay, it's ironic, is it not? Anyhow. That's just a joke. I'm not really saying you should vote for anybody. Once we recognize this pattern, you can start to see the model extending all across Winger Washington. Outsource the job orders the free market, the market-based ideology. And, of course, a contractor would be duly chosen. But not just any old contractor, and not even the low bidder necessarily. It always had to be a contractor whose conservative bona fides were well-known, right, who was ready to tithe back to the movement that gave it to him, who was ready to help, or I should say willing to help build one of the ideological retirement homes, you know, the think tanks, the lobby shops, that would then furnish our conservative friends with a plush free market sinecure once their days in public service were over. And this brings us to the related issue known as the revolving door, in which government workers and sometimes even our elected officials appear to do these sort of astounding favors for private companies. And then, lo and behold, they go on to take these extremely lucrative jobs at those very same companies once their time in government is done. And there's countless examples of this in action. But my favorite one remains the people who wrote the Bush administration's prescription drug benefit program, whom the administration plucked from the pharmaceutical industry and who went back there as soon as they had finished their work. And you remember, work that turned out to be incredibly shoddy from a public perspective because it doesn't control costs, but immensely profitable from the perspective of their once and future employers. And this wasn't just one or two guys. This was 15 of the public officials involved in crafting that law who left for the greener pastures of Big Pharma as soon as the law was passed, including a powerful House committee chairman who became a Big Pharma lobbyist, pulling down over $2 million a year. And by the way, that's where he is still today. He's in the newspapers in Washington all the time because, of course, he's sitting in on all the discussions on the healthcare reform. Now, the greatest example of market-based government in action, of course, was in the financial sector, where our various regulatory agencies napped right through the building crisis. Now, why was that? Why did it happen? I think it's at least partially because of the kind of people that were chosen for the job. I mean, they were asleep at the switch because they were supposed to be. It was as though they had been hired for their extraordinary powers of drowsiness. The reason for that is simple when it turns out. It turns out there's powerful institutions in America. This is going to be news to you guys, but there's powerful institutions in this country that don't like being regulated, okay? I don't know if you're aware of this, but regulation cuts into their profits and interferes with their business. And so they have used the political process over the years to sabotage, control, redirect, defund, or undo the regulatory state, basically ever since the regulatory state was first invented back in the 1880s. Now, we'll skip all the history and come straight up to the present. In the Bush administration, this strategy was elevated to a sort of snickering, sarcastic art form, right? An FDA that sometimes looked as if it was basically taking its orders from Big Pharma. An EPA that could never rouse itself from the lazy boy. An energy policy that might as well have been dictated by Enron. And, of course, banking regulators who posed for pictures with banking lobbyists while holding a chainsaw to a pile of regulations and red tape. Hey, smiles all around, right? Let those good fellows at IndyMac do just whatever the hell they want. Now, the agency that I'm referring to is the Office of Thrift Supervision. They're one of our banking regulators. And they explicitly referred to the industry that they were supposed to oversee as their customers. That was, again, this is now the second or third time that we've heard that term. And they treated that industry with the sort of leniency that you would associate with an attitude like that. For one example out of many, back in the middle of 2008, the Office of Thrift Supervision permitted IndyMac, which soon would be, as we all know, dragged down by bad mortgage debt, to alter their records to avoid the appearance of crisis. Or take the Securities and Exchange Commission, the famous top cop on Wall Street, right, who so famously missed the grandest Ponzi scheme in history, despite numerous attempts to bring it to the SEC's attention. Here it is, guys, but they missed it again and again and again. Now, why did they fail? To find out the answer, you've got to go all the way back to the 1980s when we started changing the nature of the SEC, drawing the people who managed it from Wall Street instead of promoting them from within. One of these guys said back in 1984, this is a quote from one of their officers, "The best of all worlds is the termination of federal regulation." Now, in the Bush years, the agency set new records for groveling subservience to industry. In 2005, they thoughtfully set up a telephone hotline for members of the regulated community. They began a voluntary supervision. Let Wall Street supervise themselves. Don't you just love that idea? I mean, that's like, all right. I mean, even if all you knew about Wall Street was what you'd seen in the movies, you'd know that's not going to work. Right? Voluntary supervision. Why'd they do it? Because Wall Street asked them to do it that way. It turns out they were about to be regulated by the European Union, unless, of course, I'm referring to the international holding companies that own the investment banks, unless the SEC regulated these particular operations. So their good pals at the SEC said, sure, we'll set that up for you. Done, you know? Now, this agency was, at the same time that this is going on, the agency was so understaffed that lawyers at its enforcement division would spend a lot of their time doing filing, photocopying, and they would have to go, since they didn't have photocopiers in the office, they had to go down to Kinko's to do their photocopying. They'd have to sort their own mail and all these other sort of routine office chores. And, you know, while they're going head-to-head with some of the, you know, sharpest and best-paid lawyers in the world, that's who they're going up against. Now, all of this has utterly predictable results. Over the course of the Bush years, prosecutions of SEC cases fell by 87%. In 2008, the year when all financial hell broke loose, the SEC brought the fewest prosecutions it had since 1991. So this is how it works when you've got conservatives at the helm. You starve government agencies of resources. You keep their employees' pay well below their private sector counterparts. You make sure that we know what we think of them while they wait for their turn at the photocopier. And then we demand that they protect us when there's a problem with extremely complex financial instruments. You know, instruments whose designers are protected by some of the best paid lawyers in the world. And when these regulators inevitably fail, we declare that the problem begins and ends with them. I believe it was Daryl Issa who said that. I think he's from like Ohio or something. What?
No, he's from California.
Okay. All right. Now, but I might be getting the quote. That's not the exact quote. You'll have to look it up yourself. But it was something to that effect. Now, our ancestors understood that capitalism requires supervision, and when you take that supervision away, or when you defund the supervisors, or when you make them answer to the supervisor, when you replace them with a voluntary compliance program, suddenly you've got diseased factories shipping salmonella-laced peanut butter throughout the country. You've got worthless mortgage-backed securities, you know, rated AAA, backed up by useless appraisals issued by defunct banks, but you've got these toxic securities sickening financial institutions from San Diego to Budapest. You've got the world's greatest Ponzi scheme spreading its gift of bankruptcy throughout the land. And so thus did the conservative movement keep its appointment with destiny. Free market techniques secured for it a world of free markets. Criminal techniques gave us a land in which crime was triumphant. And with their eyes fixed firmly on their 19th century utopia, its armies of privatizers, pressure boys, pack men, political entrepreneurs, and professional victims made the world safe for predation. And now, as the rest of us struggle, they tell us that the problem with the old system was that there wasn't any regulation at all, that government has been the problem all along, that the real solution is to put conservatives back in government, to let them finally have a try. As Tom DeLay told us, they never did really get a try in the first place, but let them finish the wrecking job that their predecessors began. Thank you very much. It's not a church. We're not in a church, are we?
We are not in a church.
Oh, okay. So beer is allowed?
Have a drink.
All right.
And welcome.
So everybody, you can open your beer now.
I hope you brought brown paper bags, though. I want to take you back a little bit and talk about conservatism before the conservative movement you've described. There is a form of conservatism that actually tries to conserve good things about society and tries to conserve tradition, right?
Yeah, that's by the way, I'm I'm sure I don't sound like it when I mouth off like this. I have a lot of sympathy for that. That's the kind of person that I am. I am in some ways very traditional. However, one of the things that I realized when I was younger, and I even used to identify as a conservative back in the 1980s. One of the things that I came to discover, and I guess everybody does at some point, is that I'm something of a cultural conservative. The capitalist system that we live under is profoundly disruptive of tradition in the cultural field. I mean, it just, things zoom by a mile a minute. It's the most culturally destructive, what do you call it? What's the term for it? Creative destruction, the Schumpeter's term. And that's I don't like that. But I'm getting off the point. You wanted to stick to the political subject. There's a kind of conservatism that we don't see anymore. Okay, let me take a step back here. I shouldn't have started on that beer. I knew that was a terrible mistake. I was on my way out here last night. I was reading Richard Hofstadter's book, The Paranoid Style in American Politics. Hofstadter was the greatest American historian of his time. The book was published in 1965, and it was his thoughts on the conservative movement. And he said, much as I'm going to say right now, that there was this sort of legitimate form of conservatism, this kind of Edmund Burke-style conservatism that he had a lot of affection for and that I have a lot of affection for. But what he saw in the Goldwater movement and in what he called the paranoid style, where, there's all these, conjecture about people's secret socialist motives, which we're seeing again now, about the sort of hypnotic power that liberals are supposed to have, which we're seeing again now, that all of this stuff, this is not a truly conservative thing. It's deeply radical. It aims to tear up what was then the consensus in American life. The New Deal was here to stay. Social Security was here to stay. These were elements of modern life, of modernity, that you couldn't just throw overboard. You take a guy like Paul Weyrich, who's another sort of great leader of the conservative movement, who has said, and I'm going to bungle the quote again because I don't memorize these things, but that we are not, how did he put it? Did he say we aren't conservatives? Or he said that we are radicals because we aim to tear down the status quo. We're not really trying to conserve anything. Hmm. We're trying to overturn the status quo. I've got the quote in The Wrecking Crew. It's one of the, he's another sort of brilliant figure in conservative DC. But I have a warm spot in my heart for that sort of traditional, Norman Rockwell, Frank Capra, conservatism. I love that stuff. I'm a total sucker for that stuff. That's one of the reasons I used to like Ronald Reagan, that kind of Reader's Digest, sunshiny world that he would talk about. But it's his system that wrecked that world.
Do you think there's anybody in contemporary politics who represents that kind of conservatism, the very traditional?
What is that? I was going to say there's Dwight Eisenhower.
Yeah, yeah. But it really started to turn about that time, anti-communism, all the HUAC stuff.
Well, it's basically just to, totally unleash the free market in so many aspects of American life, beat down the labor unions, have the free trade agreements, and let business do as they want, redraw the maps of the city, redraw industry. Look at a place like Detroit now. I mean, that's conservatism that did that to that place. By my way of looking at it, other people would say it's you guys that did that to Detroit. But, it is in some ways it is a destroyer, not a preserver, the free market system. But I'm getting pretty far afield from what you're asking. You're asking who out there?
Yeah, is there?
Oh golly, I don't know. I'll think of somebody tomorrow when I'm on the airplane.
We only have an hour for this program, but if you come up with anybody,
okay,
let us know. I think one of the other things that really struck me about the book is how, for this strain of conservatism, corruption is actually a good thing, not only because they often profit from it, but because it proves government can't work.
That's right. It gives you an object lesson. This is Jack Abramoff himself has said that. And Jack Abramoff is one of the main characters in the book. He fascinates me for a lot of different reasons. One of them is that he was, even while his name has become synonymous with corruption, even while he was doing all this stuff, the man remained something of an idealist, a real believer in the conservative cause. And he was one of the people that the story of his career showed me that in conservative Washington, you can be a corruptionist and an idealist at the same time. That the two don't necessarily conflict, because he was practicing his conservatism through the activities that you and I consider to be corrupt. And I went a little deeper, so I started looking into all of the different people that were implicated in his scandal. A lot of them have written books, have written articles, done interviews, and many of them are corruption theorists themselves. They've written about corruption, they've denounced corruption, they think they're experts on corruption. One of the guys involved in the Paola pundit business, you know, the pundits for hire, wrote a whole book about how corrupt Washington liberalism was. He was an expert on corruption. Michael Scanlon, who was Abramoff's right-hand man in a lot of the kickback schemes and that sort of thing, got an MA degree at a university near Washington, and his thesis was about political corruption. These guys were both theorists of corruption and practitioners of corruption at the same time. It was a fascinating story. But there's a bunch of other reasons why. Well, so then I started looking into conservative theory about corruption. And when you start to dig, these very same people that are, you know, imagine themselves to be great theorists of corruption say, well, other things that we consider illegal shouldn't be illegal at all. Like price fixing, that shouldn't be illegal. You know, restraint of trade, or price gouging, another one. Why is that illegal? And they go on down the line. Even bribery. There are even people that none of Abramoff's, nobody in his circle, of course, but I was able to find professional economists that say, hey, in a lot of circumstances, bribery is a good thing. It is the way the market operates. The market speaks through bribery. The market influences. It's market-based government.
Bribery is just the market acting in self-defense.
That's right. That was quote,
quote from your text.
Yes. And I'm sorry, I should shut up now, but it was shocking when I found this stuff. And so I'm trying to convey a little bit of that to you. This was, I did not expect to find people standing up for corruption.
And one of the things all this achieves is to reduce trust in government.
And that's a good thing by their lights.
Explain that.
Because if government fails, if government is visibly just given over to the people who can afford it, to the people who can buy it, then your trust in government diminishes, and the conservatives have won. Abramoff had a way of putting it. He said it in an interview with Vanity Fair. Not that he didn't make that particular point, but he made a different point that the only way to stop people like him was to do away with big government altogether. That was the only way. Otherwise, people like him would always get through. And you know they would do what he was doing. So what in this way of seeing it, and again I'm paraphrasing, that's not even close to being an exact quote. But in this way of seeing things, what he was doing was teaching us a lesson in why government is futile. And so it was, you know, it was idealism and corruption at the same time. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I think part of the achievement of the conservatives that you're talking about is to build that mistrust in government, and we're seeing so much of that come out in the debate around health care. Now.
That's right.
So one of the questions that has come up is can President Obama, can the Democrats, how can they rebuild trust?
Well, that's a huge task, you understand. Now, I think that the public is in the sort of position where we would like to see, a reaffirmation of, you know, of the goodness of government if he would just come out and do it. This is one of the, I voted for Obama. I even voted for Obama when he was a state senator. I used to live in his district in Chicago, and I always liked the guy. But one of the things that I'm really disappointed in him, one of the reasons I'm disappointed in him is that he doesn't come out and give us a kind of ringing vindication of the role of government in American life. And you look at the debate over healthcare that's going on right now, you know, these town hall debates where the people show up and they ask their congressman a lot of sort of silly questions, but also a lot of very good questions. They're hostile to healthcare reform, or to at least the healthcare reform that the Democrats have proposed so far. But the questions are still good ones. They deserve an answer. And when they talk about that, you know, we want to know about the nature of government. We think that this is a step towards tyranny. We think this is a government takeover of the economy. They deserve an answer. You know, they deserve to be told why, when government, you know, that government intervention in the economy might, in a lot of cases, give you more freedom, not less. But nobody comes out and says that. The congressmen never give them a, you know, explain to them why or talk about why government is a, can be, I mean, a force for good in American life. It's as though these ideas are too abstract for them. And, you know, Democrats today, they just want to talk about the details of everything, the technocracy angle. So, see, I just talk too damn much.
Yeah. This is the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley. We're talking to Thomas Frank, author of The Wrecking Crew, and What's the Matter with Kansas? We have lots of questions from the audience. Thomas, here's one. What has the role of media been in the advancement of the rejection of government?
I think it's a big role because of the, you know, we think about these things in such a different way. I was just, the column that I wrote that's going to be in the Wall Street Journal tomorrow is about the sort of a revival of the paranoid style just in the last couple of weeks here, or couple of months, or however you want to put it. And at the end of the, I was sitting there just, you know, scratching my head. It's like, why is this so attractive to people to imagine that government is that we're on the verge of tyranny, that our government is harboring secret communists, you know, that there's treachery and betrayal all around us. And the more I thought about it, the more it seems like a movie. We're living in a movie where we are stepping up to the plate, or we're, you know, walking up to the microphone in the town hall meeting, and we're giving that congressman a piece of our minds, and we are like the founding fathers standing up for liberty. And there's something very noble about that, as long as you regard it as a piece of entertainment, you know. But when you think about it in any other terms, there's something really, really, really wrong. But that's just, I'm sorry, that's a lame answer, but that's the best I can do for now.
Okay. Does it bother you that the Treasury Secretary and others in authority come from Wall Street? Why is Obama seemingly so complicit? What's to prevent the same crisis from happening again?
Yes, it bothers me. I had a lot of objections to Tim Geithner when he first came in. For example, he had been the chairman of the New York Fed, and he didn't seem to understand that he had had a regulatory role. There was one time where he said, oh, you know, I'm not a regulator. Well, he is or was a regulator, and he certainly is a regulator now at the Treasury Department, and he didn't seem to understand that. And I don't think that they were – I don't think that they moved swiftly enough on the financial crisis. Look, but all these arguments are water under the bridge now because, the stock market at least has turned a corner. We're slowly there's no doubt but that recovery seems to be happening very slowly, and the urgency has come off of a lot of these arguments. But at the same time, you know, it was a moment for huge. And, you know, something else. Geithner said something pretty smart the other day. You know, what I was saying in my talk about the Office of Thrift Supervision, he said something very, very similar to that. He talked about regulatory capture and how a lot of these agencies failed in the Bush years because they were basically beholden to industry. And I thought that was remarkable that Tim Geithner came out and said that, because that's a huge problem at the Federal Reserve as well. If any of y'all know how the Federal Reserve works, bankers in the various big cities actually have a say in who are the regional Fed chairman. It's not just we the people that chooses them. It is owners of banks. If there was ever an agency designed to be captured, it's the Fed, you know, or at the regional level, not at the national level. But he came out and he really he really nailed that one. And I hope they push through the various regulatory reforms that they were talking about. But by and large, though, he and Larry Summers strike me as being too timid to get any kind of real sweeping reform done.
Actually, we have a question about the prospects of those reforms, particularly some of those that have been proposed by Bernie Sanders and others on financial regulation. So you think the prospects aren't good?
I think that they will have to, they're going to have to re-regulate. They may even have to bring back some version of the Glass-Steagall Act, which will be highly ironic, you know, because that was such one of the great triumphs of the Clinton years was repealing Glass-Steagall. You know, this is Clinton signed it. It was passed by the Republicans in the House and the Senate back in those days. And this was the crowning glory of the new economy. Remember? I mean, y'all don't remember, but this is an earlier book that I wrote called One Market Under God, sort of dwelled on this subject at some length. And now the next Democratic administration is going to have to put that in reverse. I think they have to do it. There's no doubt about it. Whether they'll regulate wisely is a different question. Look, at the end of the day, I don't think I talk too damn much. I like Obama. Like I said, I voted for Obama, like him a lot. But I think that these people cannot seem to get over the myth of the free market. They can't, the whole sort of superstition of rational markets. These people were all Geithner, Larry Summers, and Obama himself were trained in this stuff. It's deep in, I mean, it's how they understand the world. For them to move away from this stuff is going to be very, very hard. I don't know if they'll, I don't know. Who the hell knows? Not me. I just live in D.C. I don't know anything about the place.
Well, another challenge for them, I want to quote you something else from the book. For its survival, liberalism depends on fair play by its sworn enemies, making it vulnerable to assassination, hijacking, or sabotage by any party that refuses to play by the rules.
That's not me saying that. Who was it? That's that's the suicide of the West.
Yes.
James Burnham.
Yeah, you were.
He was
paraphrasing,
a big conservative. No, that's a quote.
Okay.
Yeah. That was another work of conservative theory from the 1960s, where he was talking about that liberalism depends on fair play by its. What he meant was communists. Liberalism, that ultimately we're in this Cold War with the communists and they don't play fair. But who's out there quoting communists on the tactics? Of course, it's Grover Norquist, talking about Stalin, and it's as though his movement took, his arguments about the suicide of liberalism and said, let's do it to them. Let's take them on in exactly the same way.
So can liberals ever stand up to that? You also talked about the hard right and the soft left at a certain point in the book.
I think they can stand up to it. They need to get a backbone. That's for damn sure. They certainly had one in the old days. The guys that I always go back to is Harry Truman. I'm from Kansas City. I love Harry Truman, and you talk about a real peppery guy. I was reading a bunch of the speeches that he gave during the 1948 campaign, and it was seriously the other way around then. He was the tough one, the hard-nosed one, the guy with the sharp words, and it was the Republican opponent, Tom Dewey, that seemed soft by comparison. But they don't make him like Harry Truman anymore.
No, and Obama's not like Harry Truman.
No, Obama
he's not
does not
get like
have that.
Harry Truman.
He rises to the occasion sometimes. At the Democratic convention, he gave his acceptance speech, was a very Truman-esque sort of thing, but it's unusual for him. He's a very conciliatory guy. He believes in compromise. The bipartisanship thing is deep in his DNA. We're going to find out tomorrow, Wednesday. This is the moment for him to stand up and to realize that he's not going to get anywhere compromising. With the Republicans are playing a very interesting hand, a very interesting strategy in Washington right now. And I think Obama certainly realizes by now that by coming into office saying, oh, this administration is going to be all about bipartisanship, he was doing exactly what you said in the Burnham quote, that liberalism depends upon the fair play of its rivals for any kind of success. And when they're not going to play fair, you've got to change your strategy. But the Republican strategy is fascinating. Having been essentially, confuted by history itself, right? Their whole philosophy of governance just, coming crashing down in the last couple of years, and especially the disaster related with the financial crisis. What do these guys decide to do? Are they going to change their tack, right? Are they going to, moderate the way they govern, what they promise to the nation? Or are they going to, declare that Bush was not an authentic conservative and that we just need a dose of the real thing and that's the only solution for us? Double down on what they were doing last time around. And obviously the answer is the latter. They've declared that Bush was not a real conservative. Like I said, the caller today, Tom DeLay, saying, look, conservatives never really got a chance. I always get a kick out of that. Tom DeLay saying that. And double down on their strategy. And it's fascinating because it's so, they're not even giving Obama a chance. And second of all, they certainly realized that while this strategy might work and might get them back into power, what a disaster it will be for the country if they succeed with it.
We have quite a few questions about the media. This one is, what is your view of the growing conservative presence on the news networks and talk radio and the popularity of Fox News and Rush Limbaugh? What do you see as the future of our media?
Well, it seems to get worse every year, doesn't it? I have a friend, he's the editor of a newspaper in France, and he comes over to America every 4 years for the political conventions. And we drive, last time he came over, I took him to West Virginia, and we drove all around West Virginia, and I made him listen to Rush Limbaugh all the time, and we shopped at Walmarts. And and he said, you know, every 4 years I come back, and every 4 years it's worse. And, you know, I remember when I first heard about Rush Limbaugh. He's from Kansas City, or he rose to prominence in Kansas City. And people thought this was outrageous at the time, the sort of things that he was saying on the radio. And I listen to him nowadays, and I don't think it's all that bad. Rush Limbaugh has even said, this is crazy, but he once said some nice things about me a number of years ago. I think it might have been by mistake, but nevertheless, he did. And but then you watch something like O'Reilly took it farther than that. You know, and O'Reilly is, again, a master of the field that he works in, but the bullying, the meanness, the savagery, he went considerably farther than Limbaugh. And now you have Glenn Beck, who's gone even farther than O'Reilly and who seems to be single-handedly trying to stir up his own Red Scare. You know, this is an extraordinary thing that he's doing. And each of these guys has been a notable success in their field. And so this makes you wonder. I mean, we're talking about commercially here, not politically. Commercially speaking, this phenomenon should just get worse and worse and worse and worse. That's the direction. All the incentives are pointing that way. You know, it should just get worse because every time it gets worse, it's more successful. I mean, worse by my standards, of course. Even from the sort of the standard of the you know paranoid right, it's more and more excellent. Every 4 years. This is strong stuff.
Okay. When we look at issues like the health care reform debate and the controversy over Obama's speech to school children, why are Republicans able to get their message across so much more efficiently, effectively than Democrats?
Because their message is about myth. The Democrats, like I said, are caught up in the technical details. Did any of you watch those town hall meetings on TV or listen to them on the radio? I was astonished at how the questions kept coming back to grand, sweeping questions of government's role in society, the nature of tyranny, and the usually the Democratic congressmen or senators who were under fire would always go back to the details, the PowerPoint presentation, you know, the comparing this plan to that plan. They never were able to talk on the level of myth. And the conservatives have I think, understand that. They transformed a debate over technical details into a culture war, into something beyond a culture war, into a cultural crusade. And they did it really fast. Well, it caught on because it's effective. And have you considered how effective, we're talking about incentives for things to get worse and worse and worse, how each of the sort of Looney Tunes rumors that come up, first about Obama and his birth certificate, then about the death panels, then about Obama having this Svengali power over children, you know, that each of these has been notably successful. Each of them, I mean, while they aren't true and they have no, you know, they aren't related to reality in any particular way, they have, as we say in Washington, they've moved the needle. They've converted people. They've brought people around. And the Democrats don't have any response except for to say, oh, that stuff's not true. It's not true. He's not really a hypnotist, you know, which is, I guess, the only really response that you can give. But Democrats have to fight back at the level of myth and at the level of grand ideology. And it just frustrates me so deeply that they can't seem to do it. They can't turn it on. They can't pull a Harry Truman on these guys. I used to say during the campaign, Obama has to reach for his inner Kansan. And we think of Kansas as, I'm from Kansas, we think of Kansas as a very conservative place, but it's also a very populist place. at the end of the day. That's ultimately what it comes down to. Whether Kansas is on the left, which it used to be, or on the right, which it is now, it's always a very populist place. And Obama needs to learn, or Obama has to choose a surrogate who can learn to speak in those populist tones. Because I'm telling you, that is what wins the day.
Speaking of those town hall meetings, I have liberal friends who are absolutely persuaded that all that outrage is absolutely set up, that they're all staffers for Big Pharma or
they might be, but again, it worked, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely something peculiar going on there. I mean, you have congressmen in these very liberal districts. They show up for their town hall meeting, and every single person there is like, you know, sent over by the Ayn Rand Society or something like that, you know. And that's really strange. But even so, the questions were legitimate. The whole idea, if it was a PR strategy, it was a damned good one, because they asked questions that everybody is wondering in the back of their mind. And the congressman, by and large, failed to answer them. Or the congressman that we saw on TV. And maybe they showed them on TV because they couldn't answer them, and it made for good TV, you know. Here's this incompetent buffoon waffling before a crowd of angry, John Doe types, you know.
Very Frank Capra.
It'd be like the evil Frank Capra.
Okay, at a time when Democrats hold majorities in both houses, why has health care reform become such a challenge? Shouldn't this have been an easy task for them since they even have the traditional foes of health care reform on board, some of them?
Isn't that funny? It started out just 3 months ago. I was writing about this in the Wall Street Journal either last week or a few weeks ago. It started out, it was going to be such a cakewalk. Do you remember this? In the Washington Post, they had this big story. Obama had all these people the very individuals who had torpedoed Clinton's health care plan were on board this time. They had this joint press conference at the White House. They were going to get it done. It was going to be a consensus effort of good old Washington, D.C. And this time, you know, so they were going to do the reform from on high, and who should torpedo it, but this time, average people, the very people who wanted it last time around. Last time it was torpedoed by Big Pharma. This time it's, you know, average people showing up at the town hall meetings and wrecking the whole thing. It's a weird topsy-turvy situation, but they could still, look, the fact is the Democrats could still push it through if they chose, and I hope they do choose. I have very good reasons to support universal health care, my own personal experiences and the experiences of people that I, and we all know people, we all have good reasons everybody knows disasters where universal health care could have solved the problem and gotten relatives or friends of ours out of trouble. But I think that they will, one of the sort of strategies that you hear about a lot in Washington, D.C. is just pushing it through and letting it build its own constituency in the same way that Social Security did. And Social Security, you'll recall, back in 1935 and 1936, was opposed on largely the same grounds, that it was an act of tyranny, that it was an intrusion of big government into the relationship between employer and employee, you know, that it was a step towards totalitarianism. Well, they didn't have that word at the time, but they said it was, in so many words, because it gave you this number and that kind of thing. And you're hearing all the same arguments again now, and if they just get some backbone and push it through, it will build its own constituency. I think that is probably true, but I think that's a very risky strategy. I think the wise strategy is to build, to rebuild public support for it and push it through at the same time, and I hope Obama does both.
This is the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We're talking to Thomas Frank, author of The Wrecking Crew, and
What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yeah.
That last statement. Another reason that the Democrats have to push it through is because if they don't, they lose their raison d'etre as a party. We're here in the Petit Trianon, so I can say that. I mean, this is a party that exists because of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the idea of social insurance back in the 1930s. They have been fighting for some form of national health insurance ever since Harry Truman, right? And they've come close a number of times, but they've never gotten it. This time, all the stars are aligned. And if they can't deliver it this time, I mean, there's no point in having a second party, you know? Why bother?
Well, that sort of relates to the next question from the audience. Aren't both U.S. political parties complicit in the neocon job that turned over political power and the U.S. Treasury to large corporate interests?
Well, to some degree, yes. This is a subject of a previous book of mine. It was called One Market Under God, and it was about the idea of the consensus idea of the 1990s. By the way, the book has a lot of really mean things to say about the great heroes of Silicon Valley. Because Silicon Valley developed, was sort of the birthplace of the great ideology of the 1990s, a sort of soft libertarianism, you know, that everyone from Bill Clinton to George Gilder signed on to. And, you know, in some ways, that was Clinton's historical role, was to legitimate the Reagan Revolution in some ways, to accept the free market ideology. And then now it's all come crashing down. The Democrats have to relearn real quick why they set up things like the Securities and Exchange Commission in the first place, way back in the 1930s. And it's hard for them, but in some ways history is forcing it on them to learn why they are who they are. isn't that a funny way of putting it? But it's true.
Okay, next audience question. What's been the role of our weak and underfunded education system in the creation of a nation of ignorance, gullibility, hating, and fearful of fear of government?
Hey, I went to that public education system.
I
I'm sending my kids to it. We just moved to the state of Maryland, and there they just started public school there. But I went through the public schools in Johnson County, Kansas, and then I went to the University of Virginia. And then I went to the University of Chicago, and that turns out it's not a public school. I thought it was.
Yeah.
I signed up. That's a joke, folks. I don't know. I would say that the role of the education system is not so much that the education system itself has failed us, but that it's become a kind of lightning rod for a certain kind of criticism from the right. And this was one of the subjects in What's the Matter with Kansas. In Kansas, we were having this big fight over the theory of evolution, if you can imagine that. Maybe you'll have one of these days in California. That would be a lot of fun. You can get a taste of what we've had out in Kansas. But what it always comes back to is a war on what the right calls elites and elitism. But what you and I would call professionals and professionalism. So you have public school teachers and you have university professors. And public school teachers, like journalists and like government bureaucrats, regard themselves as professionals. In fact, they are members of a profession. And they have certain professional standards that they want to meet, and that they do meet. And those standards are what they are, regardless of what the public has to say about it. So they accept certain, you know, doctrines that are taught in mainstream science, whether or not the public approves of those doctrines. And this, it turns out, is one of those great contradictions in the liberal state that the right has seized upon and loves to pound at, because this is an act of elitism, this sort of professional attitude by school teachers. And college professors are even worse. And in Kansas, the right figured this out. And they love to have public hearings where they put these college professors on the spot. Because the college professor will be like, you know, I don't care what you say. I have a PhD. And in my discipline and in my peer-reviewed journals, we think that the theory of evolution is true, you know. And I don't care what you say. And I don't care how many millions of you say otherwise. In our discipline, it is regarded as true. And this is, you know, and that is, frankly, undemocratic. And the right knows this. And they know how much this makes people angry. And so they love to rub that in people's faces. It's a very effective strategy. And they do the same thing with professions in all different walks of life. Lawyers, the trial lawyers. You all know the rap against them. Doctors, in the whole abortion controversy. If you read the anti-abortion literature, it's largely about the medical profession and its power to, you know, decide life and death. The death panel business. That's where all of this comes from. This is a long-standing fear on the right that they will start doing, you know, eugenics or euthanasia or something like that. Professionals with their professional expertise will decide that you and I aren't, you know, don't deserve to live by appealing to some, you know, set of criteria that you and I don't have access to, because we're just average citizens. We're just, you know, Joe Blow with our one man, one vote. This is a very powerful doctrine. Okay? The thing is that they did it deliberately. I mean, they decided to go after schools deliberately. There was a time when schools weren't controversial. I mean, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm getting off the subject. I was about to start talking about Anne of Green Gables. I have an 8-year-old girl. She's reading Anne of Green Gables. Anne is a school teacher in a one-room schoolhouse. Okay, it's in Canada, but it's still, you know, it's this beautiful Norman Rockwell picture of the time when schools weren't all that controversial, except for corporal punishment. Okay, next question.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for just one last question, but it's a broad one. So if you were rewriting What's the Matter with Kansas today, would it be What's the Matter with America? How would you change what you wrote?
I like that book. I like it a lot. I didn't have any idea when I wrote it that it would catch on the way I did, the way it did. The Wrecking Crew is the one that I really put my heart into it. I researched like crazy. I interviewed dozens of people in Washington, D.C. Among other people, I interviewed Grover Norquist for the book and Richard Viguerie and a number of other conservatives. Very, very interesting people. And I think I've got a very highly polished version of that book now out in paperback. What's the Matter with Kansas? You know, in some ways, it was just about 6 months ago, I thought, finally, the culture wars are over. I mean, Sarah Palin was a sort of classic culture war candidate, right? And McCain brought her on because he himself couldn't bring it with regards to the culture wars. That's not his terrain. And she was perfect. And when she went down to defeat in the way that they did, you know, the resounding defeat that happened to them, I thought, finally, maybe the culture wars are over. But then I put down the beer and I was like, no. No, they'll be back. They'll be back. And they'll be back in some hideous new form. And we're finding out what that is right now.
I hope you enjoyed tonight's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Thomas Frank, author of The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Ruined Government, Enriched Themselves, and Beggared the Nation. We'd like to thank our audience here in San Jose and also those of you joining us on radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.